Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of The Group Chat. I am news correspondent here at Virgin Media News, Richard Chambers. I'm joined by my fellow news correspondent, Zara King.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, I'm good actually.
And Gavin Ryan.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think we're rearing to go here now. I'm getting some summer vibes. Are you getting summer vibes?
It is, yeah. 20 degrees this weekend.
Yeah, it's been quite nice.
I've broken open my emergency antihistamines, so it's definitely summer vibes.
And I've got an extra highlight to put in, so summer started for me,
there you
for
go.
Sure.
Never a truer sign of summer than the highlights and the antihistamines.
Clear in the Munster Hurling final, and we've got our hair dye and antihistamines. She wants not to love.
We're heading forwards another long hot summer if Clare are doing well in the Munster Championship. But
how's Waterford doing, by the way, or dare I ask?
Done.
Oh man.
Okay.
Another day's story.
She went there.
All right. Okay.
Oh dear.
Anyway, peak of the news headlines again is what we were talking about last week, which is the government's increasingly fractured attempt at securing accommodation for international protection applicants, as well as the number of protests and blockades that we've now seen and the emergence of national awareness really around the far right and their activities in this country, as well as other hardline anti-immigration activists. So now, as of yesterday, Roderick O'Gorman was telling The Dáil there's about 199, I think it is, people who are without accommodation, who are international protection applicants. The government's aim is to get that below 100 by the June bank holiday. But as we have seen repeatedly, Zara, getting people into accommodation as they acquire a new accommodation is not so straightforward a thing.
Yeah, and the whole aspect of integration seems to be lacking from those transitions into accommodation, because it seems that most people in these local communities where asylum seekers are being moved are actually not being told that this is happening, and the whole aspect of actually integrating people into society seems to be lacking, and we've seen that unfold again over the last couple of days. Richard, you were reporting the night on one particular incident which became quite heated.
Yes, I think this is going to be something as well. I think we have heard from people, including the Justice Minister, Simon Harris, and now he's somewhat backtracked on this, or has said, well, obviously you are able to question the Gardaí in the grandest sense of things, but he says that it's not for any of us. Anybody who's sitting behind a desk, as he said multiple times, or sitting in the Dáil or behind a microphone to question the operational decisions of a guard on the beat. But there have been questions about how Gardaí have policed anti-migrant protests, whether it be an Inch with the blockade, whether it be Sandridge Street or Santry, which has been going on for 3 weeks without actually much notoriety until the arrival of the National Party at last weekend. But this is something which is probably likely to continue to happen, because we now have a number of other blockades which are being prepared, whether or not there actually is any migrant accommodation going in there.
There is a sense that some of those other blockades are now occurring because of the Gardaí's somewhat understated policing response to what we saw in Inch. So, for example, the guards were saying that in Inch, what the proposal or the tack they were taking was very non-confrontational. They were trying to do everything they possibly could so as not to escalate the situation. And it might have been broadly successful in that instance, but it has, whether deliberately or not, almost provided this template, where because others who might be minded to do similarly know the guards are never going to move in and pull down a blockade, that it effectively gives others a charter that they know what they can do without the guards getting in the way.
Yeah, but there does have to be questions asked about how it's being handled and sort of what are the parameters for which, you know, Garda Síochána can intervene. Or, like, I mean, even when it comes down to sort of the narrative, say, for example, from the Taoiseach this week, where he'll say, look, you know, we respect people's right to protest, but at the end of the day, like, people don't have a say or a call on who moves into their community. All of that is, you know, it's fine commentary, but like, what does it actually mean in the grand scheme of things, in terms of action on the ground, in terms of the demonstrations, in terms of how those demonstrations are policed, in terms of how the community are communicated with? It goes back to that conversation around integration. You know, a lot of it is rhetoric, but what does it actually mean when you're on the ground?
There's a couple of different points on it. If you take the policing point of it, the idea and the criticism pointed at the Gardaí is that by doing nothing or taking the hands-off approach, or the softly-softly approach, as I put it towards Drew Harris, and he denied that was such a thing, is that you'll encourage more and more people to do this because they've seen that it can be successful and they can get plenty of notoriety for these protests, get plenty of media attention, even websites on the right around the world have picked up on things like Inch and Sandwich Street as being a sign of Ireland pushing back against asylum seekers and refugees, which reputationally for the country in a political sense is probably not something which the government wants to see happen. But in terms of the overall communication aspect, this is something the government says. I mean, there's a couple of things to look at there on this. If people have actual genuine concerns about services and whatnot, I mean, Roderick O'Gorman and the Taoiseach said, particularly around Inch, said, yeah, well, we didn't get the communication aspect about that right. We probably could have given a couple more days of notice around that. But it does need to be said that some of the people who are involved in some of the blockades, whether it be in Santry or in Inch, communicated openly their feeling that it was just about, we don't want male asylum seekers coming here from different parts of the world. We don't want people with ulterior motives, as somebody is quoted as saying, to declare echo about this. So
it's the language of unvetted fighting age, that kind of language.
I mean, men stuff,
I don't think you can have all the consultation in the world about that. You're not changing people from those views.
Well, there will always be some people whose minds you're not going to change, and there'll be those who just don't want anyone else from another background in there at all. But definitely within Inch there was, and I think everyone recognises this, hindsight is obviously 2020, but that there was a failure on the communications piece where I know, for example, some local TDs, when they knew that some preparatory work was being done at McGenna House, they had put in like written requests for information to Roderick O'Gorman's department saying, right, what's going on? Not because we've got any issue, but just because it will be easier for us to make sure that it's a welcoming setting if we know what's going on and we can communicate to the, to what's going on to locals. But they ended up not getting a reply until literally as the buses were disembarking on the ground and people were being moved in. So there was no opportunity to try and smooth over any concerns. And that, although you're never going to win over everyone, those in the middle ground who would be assuaged where they just told what was going on, that opportunity was lost.
I suppose the point is, Ara, like if you aren't doing any of the prep work, because some people ask, well, why do you need to have any consultation whatsoever? But if you haven't given any sort of notice to people on the ground that this is happening, they're not getting anything from the government side or in terms of, well, why do we need to use this facility or whatever. All they're hearing potentially is anti-immigrant things and people, and you have already seen, and we've seen multiple times, representative groups, whether it be the Irish National Party or the Irish Freedom Party, other groups like that, will move in and they will have, they will provide
capitalize
information.
On the void.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so they'll try and make political gains on it. Well, so if not hearing anything alternative to that, well, that is a failure then.
Yeah, it is. And I suppose as well, as you say then, what you're having is sort of a boycott of maybe local demonstrations that might have come from a place of perhaps some sort of genuine concern about suitability of the area. And then, you know, having those hijacked perhaps by people who have ulterior motives. I do think it's interesting, though, to kind of question as well the reasons for maybe not giving communities a heads up. Is there some sort of concern about the fact that if there's any advance notice that there will be a protest organised, or that it will
That's
give the likes
well,
of
yeah.
far-right groups an insight into where things are moving to next? But like in the grand scheme of things, whether you tell people on a Monday or you tell them on a Friday, if there's going to be a demonstration, it's going to happen. It would still seem like respect for both the people who are going to be moving into the accommodation and the people in that community, for everyone to be informed and be on at least some sort of a level of footing.
Which is interesting, because if you talk about the need to not let there be a void open up that can be manipulated by those with different motives, it was interesting then to hear what Roderick O'Gorman said in the Dáil on Tuesday evening, because he was addressing this idea of, well, particularly in Inch, there were communications failures, but he was saying this is an accommodation crisis. And when we identify somewhere that people could potentially be housed, we kind of have not only this moral obligation, but also this humanitarian urgency that we need to take it up ASAP. So there isn't always going to be the chance to negotiate, is the wrong word, but even to involve local communities, or even in some way to notify them what's going on so that you can deal with the misinformation before it arises.
Yeah.
So he was kind of almost pointedly, in an unspoken way, leaving the Dáil open to this concession that we know that we're always going to be dealing with an information void.
Like, that's kind of a small bit. Like, it is a little bit of a cop-out, I think. Like, I mean, I understand, like, this is an emergency situation, so everything is moving really rapidly and really quickly. And of course, you know, you don't want to leave anyone sleeping on the street for one extra night when, of course, you could move them as soon as something becomes available. So I appreciate and I respect that. But I do think that, like, you know, like we talked about this last week, like there is a refugee camp in the middle of Dublin city centre at the moment and has been for quite some time. So yes, it's an emergency, but it's an emergency we've known about for a really long time. And there are vacant properties, and you know, every person listening to this podcast can identify a vacant property within 5 minute drive of their own home probably. And it would, you know, clearly there are vacant properties that are being identified as potentials. So if in that instance, surely there should be some preliminary communication with communities to say, listen, we have a vacant property in our community. We're making a consideration on this. It's not a guarantee, but we'd like to get together a committee. Would there be a committee, people who might be involved in the integration team, and like at least start a dialogue with people? This like this kind of idea of like, oh, you know, it's an emergency, so we're just moving really rapidly is kind of a cop-out. It's been an ongoing emergency for a really long time now.
There's a couple of reasons why I think you're probably right in that, but the government is effectively losing the battle on this one in a couple of different ways, in that nobody seems to be happy with how these things are being policed. The information going out to communities is not what it should be. And in fact, the lack of information has led itself to very difficult situations for people on the ground, whether that be in Currafin in County Clare, which is about 20 kilometres up the road from Inch, which is obviously taking a lot of the focus over the last week. But in Currafin, misinformation was put out there about an old big house, which was going to be used, as according to people who were wrong, for the accommodation of asylum seekers. Yeah. So groups who got themselves involved in the anti-immigration movement got out there, and this included members of various groupings and parties and alignments. They all got out there and did their own little blockade out there. And one man was walking past just on Sunday evening, and allegedly he was hit in the face with a torch as he went back to his house. He lives nearby to that property. Again, no asylum seekers were actually meant to be going into that place. But
was there any use for that facility then at all? Or was it just an entirely
just misinformation? There was a video which went around, which was purported to be from inside there, which showed a load of bunk beds. But again, there is no contract which was signed around that house. And this apparently was just pure misinformation.
So like unverified footage that went viral basically created a huge...
A very difficult situation. And again, like you had counter-protests there outside in Currafin as well by a load of groups who were sort of trying to say, well, Clare's reputation is taken a hit by this. We want to show that we're open to asylum seekers coming here and being welcoming. But the problem is now... that as you're sort of saying, Zara, if you start to give people heads up or people get worried that places are actually being used, people are already organising to move blockades in front of them, which is going to be a problem as this goes on, because this is going to go through the, you know, it's going to go on through the summer. And it's interesting to see one thing actually which has jarred with me, I think, actually, in terms of the communication over this. Yesterday, Roderick O'Gorman was asked about a couple of media reports around cruise ships and flotels, which is the most spinny word of all time for a barge. Like, I don't know why we can't be straightforward and call them barges, or why they haven't been referred to as that. I think that's probably going to be something which is going to change, because when Suella Braverman does it in the UK...
But in that instance, they're actually talking about a barge. They're talking about something that looks like shipping containers on a flatbed.
No, well, I mean, they're literally, they've been...
Like, that's effectively what the British one looks like. If you see the footage of it, like, there's photography of it and footage we might have even carried in our bulletins before. And, it, like, it's very industrial what they're using. Like, it to all intents and purposes...
Like, there's no windows.
But it has the physical characteristics of... almost like a shipping vehicle with like flatbed.
Like, so what I'm imagining, sorry, is it like, do you know, on a construction site, the kind of the site office would be like a container with windows, basically.
That kind of container stuff. Okay. Whereas I think from what I'd understood from the Irish perspective, they weren't talking about something quite that industrial. They were talking about passenger vessels, which looked more like ferries in the Irish instance. Not that it's a huge amount better. And by the way, I'd like naval mechanics getting in touch in the radio program on Sunday when we were talking about this. They say you still need an awful lot of expertise for people who are involved in the maintenance of that.
I was gonna say, it's like, not just like plumbing and electricity.
Yeah,
and all that kind
it's not
stuff.
Just like putting it up in berth and sticking it up in John Rogerson's key and then leaving it alone and then, hey presto, you've got a hotel. Mm. It's different. You know?
I know we need to move on, but I just want to say, just in relation to the point that you were making about the misinformation, right? We saw this similar type of misinformation at the beginning. Remember the very beginning of the pandemic? There was the whole
A lot of people were spreading it, the same people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, I just feel like we have these whole sort of narratives around lessons will be learned. What lessons were learned from that?
Nothing.
To say that like we're still back here again with people being consumed and sort of wrapped up in misinformation. I just think that there's a broader issue here that needs to be addressed. And it's a multiple of failings on the part of the government.
Well, this week there is a new awareness campaign around the issue of intimate image abuse, and particularly around the threatening of sharing intimate images. Zara, you've been working on this week. Why the renewed focus then on raising awareness around this? Is it specifically around the threatening issue and whether or not people actually know that's an offence?
Yeah, this is really important. And I think actually it's interesting because apparently 50% of people, based on the research from the Department of Justice, didn't actually know this. So if you're listening to this podcast and someone has ever threatened to share an image of you, perhaps, let's be honest, nudes, naked, explicit photos, perhaps you might have even sent them yourself. Maybe you consented to them being taken, or perhaps they were taken without your knowledge, irrespective of the circumstances of the photo being generated. If somebody has threatened to share that, even forwarded on WhatsApp, posted online, anything of that nature, the threat itself is actually a crime. Mm. And so many people don't realise that. Mm. They think, oh, but he didn't actually post it online. Or her, the fact that someone would threaten you is actually the criminal offence in itself. So the reason it's on the news agenda this week is because the Department of Justice has created a new ad campaign, television and radio campaign. We can take a quick look at the ad that's running on TV at the moment.
It's ridiculous what's going on. I told her I was going to stick shots of her up online. Shots she sent me. So they're mine, really. I know she's upset, but I haven't done it. I only said I would. I was just messing with her head. I don't even know why you're asking me about it. It's not a crime.
It is a crime. That's why we're here.
So as you can see there, the Gard clearly stating at the end of that commercial that it is a criminal offence. So look, this is about, I suppose, letting people know all of this is part of Coco's Law. People will be familiar with Jackie Fox, the mother of Nicole Fox, who's been campaigning for this for a really long time. During the week, we were speaking with Alexandra Ryan, who's one of the campaigners on this. People may have heard Ali Ryan's story. She is the founder of Goss.ie, and she spoke very publicly about 2 years ago about being in this situation where someone had threatened her to share explicit images online. And she was talking about the fact that, look, it's the threat that looms over you that is in so many ways even more difficult than the image itself, that it's that idea that somebody has that power over you, that they, you know, can try and extract, you know, money from you and make threats to you, that now we're in a situation where if this is happening to you, you can walk into your local guard station and report that and know that it will be dealt with. In relation to, I suppose, one of the questions that came up from people was, you know, well, like, how many people are charged or are there any prosecutions and is it even worth going to the guards? And that's a lot of...
Because it's a fresh enough law, isn't it? It hasn't been on the books all that long.
Yeah.
So there might not be great stats about how many prosecutions there's
been. Well, Ali gave out some stats. And again, Ali's been campaigning on this. She says over 100 charges have been... there's been over 100 charges so far and nearly 1,000 images have been taken down since the legislation came in. So look, it is slow progress, but it is progress. And I think, look, when we talk about these sort of threats and this looming sort of concern for people, it's about your reputation. It's about, you know, people being their reputation being damaged, threats for images to be sent to people's employers and whatnot. So, look, it's good for people to know as they listen to the podcast today that if you've been in this situation, you know that you can get in touch with Gardaí. There's also a website, hotline.ie, if you want to check that out as well. It's actually just... it's a really good one just in terms of information. I did get an email in from a couple of people on the DMs, but this email that came into my inbox from one person who was saying, look, my friends and I have all had this threatened and it happened in a more limited manner over the years when social media wasn't so prevalent. It would be amazing law, but I'm reluctant to be excited until I see some successful prosecutions. And again, just this person going on to talk a bit about the blackmail and extortion and demanding money and how menacing it has been and the stress that it can cause people. So...
That first line, all of my friends.
Yeah, like it's really commonplace. It's not something that, you know, maybe people don't really talk about it because I suppose the nature of it is that you're not going to have a full blown discussion about it if you're worried about something like this coming out. Like that's understandable. But actually, if you're listening to this, you should take comfort in the knowledge that you're not alone, certainly when it comes to dealing with these types of situations.
Yeah, and the judgment of any law is whether or not it actually works. So it's going to be one to monitor in terms of whether or not things are prosecuted. Gav, during the week, one of the stories which put Ireland into international headlines was alcohol warning labels. So now it's not coming into force until 2026. People might have missed that bit. So it is a few years down the line. But what's the purpose of these and why have they gone so gung-ho on something which is actually quite controversial?
Maybe it might be easier to talk about why it's controversial first, which is that it will now mean that every item of alcohol, every unit, every bottle, every can that's going to be sold in Ireland is going to have to carry mandatory health warnings. Something akin to what we used to see on tobacco, not quite as far as the plain packaging, but that they will have to carry certain guidelines as to the alcohol content and some of the health impacts of that. And the idea is that people in Ireland often find themselves not realising how much their alcohol intake influences their overall diet or their overall, for example, calorie intake or how many calories they might consume on a weekly or daily basis. And part of the thinking is that it will at least give people a slightly more rounded view of things. So, for example, people may not realise that every time that they open a can of lager, that it's, they might think about the alcohol content, but they may not think about the calorie content. So the idea is that people will have a slightly more rounded view when you're taking in that it's not just about the calories, but actually that there is a dietific, if you like, impact to all of that as well. and to make people aware of that. Now, it's been controversial because, for example, the Italian wine lobby thinks that this
is... Yes, we have a wine war.
Yeah. Well, I didn't think Ireland was going to be involved in wine wars, but here we are. The Italians are particularly incensed about this because they see this as, by and large, an attack on them, because this will now mean that an Italian exporter who wants to sell stuff in Ireland will have to produce an Ireland-specific label that conforms with the requirements of the Irish law.
Well, I, for one, hope the Italians will be put off by this.
It would be dramatic for our
Prosecco labelling is,
I was going to say, imagine if the Italian wines are and the Proseccos are off the shelves, it would be devastating.
But when we were talking about this a bit before we went live today, Rich, you pointed out that actually that there's an impact on this, or it's somewhat implicated in discussions about body image. Yeah. And actually, there was a clip that went semi-viral over the weekend, which was quite interesting.
Yeah, people who follow sport, and it might have just been across Twitter or Instagram, because I know it went viral on both. There was a clip of Jeff Selling, who does Soccer Saturday in the UK, and he was talking about it's... I think it's Mental Health Awareness Week or something in the UK, and he was talking about eating disorders and how it is basically the mental illness with the highest death toll anywhere in the Western world in terms of actual, you know, people who lose their lives through it. And basically, specifically, he mentioned one thing around calorie counts, particularly on restaurant menus. Now, there has been studies done on this, and obviously calorie counts, which are going to be part of the labels for alcohol in this country, alongside grams of alcohol, risks of cancer, liver disease, and, you know, dangers of drinking while pregnant. It's a different thing to having that in an alcoholic drink as opposed to on a menu for a restaurant. But studies
it kind of feeds
have,
into a broader culture, though, of people counting calories and whether that can always be sometimes a destructive thing.
Yeah, no. So people with eating disorders, there was a big survey done actually only last month in the UK, and they found that 84% of people with... eating disorders, people with the likes of anorexia or bulimia, actually had their recovery badly hampered as a result of calorie counts on menus, that it will feed into disordered eating and that effectively it can kill people. This can kill people. This is a health warning, but in many ways, in one of the biggest growing areas of mental illness, in eating disorders, this can be a very, very damaging and harmful thing. So it's something to bear in mind on this. It is a different situation in terms of overall menus for a restaurant versus on specific individual products. But as you say, also, there's a lot of international pressure on Ireland. As you mentioned, the Italians, the Spaniards were against this as well. The UK, the EU, the US. Everyone's not entirely happy. Even the lobby for the vintners and all that sort of stuff, they're also kind of against this as well. And we've seen the power that lobbies have in this country as well, Zara. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've been successful in the past, I suppose,
It's just a really worthwhile reminder, though, that stuff that is intended to be as a positive, like calorie counting on restaurant menus, for example, was intended to be so that people casually knew how much they were taking in, that they could moderate their intake.
It's the casually knew that you're referring to there. Nothing is casual when you're dealing with an eating disorder. It's not casual.
No, it's not casual.
It's so focused, isn't it? Yeah, because and that's a very specific sort of thing that people in that situation will hone in on, and it's actually something that's worth raising in a sense that I suppose it's not something you would consider when you say it. It makes a lot of sense.
No, and it is. It's like, I mean, people who are behind this campaign and about the initiative, they're doing it with health reasons in mind. I mean, you know, the links in terms of alcohol-related deaths in this country, alcohol-related cancers, all of those sort of things are huge impacts on people's lives and well-being. But this is just something which is probably worth considering in the round on this as well. Now, this has actually been a busy week for Ireland in terms of international headlines, because fines to be collected or to be given to Ireland.
Racking them up.
We are turning our nose up at some of them. Obviously, there's the long-going Apple case, which has been heard in Europe at the moment. 13 billion euros, which Ireland is like, no, we don't want that for whatever reason.
That's the appeal to the original ruling. So Ireland won its original case at the EU courts, but now it's appealed to the higher EU court, and the hearing was this week. So probably not getting a ruling for months, maybe not even years. But
why don't we want the 13 billion euro?
Because the government doesn't want Apple, Facebook, or any of these big companies to go, oh crap, we can't do business in Ireland, let's get out of here.
The Irish government's contention, this will sound like spin, but the Irish government's contention is that the European Commission has misunderstood the way Irish law works. So they think that we've done a sweetheart deal with Apple. We are actually saying, no, this is just the way our law works, that any big company that was intelligent enough to plan its affairs could reduce its tax liabilities in this way. And actually, they would see then this as something of a power grab by Brussels, that Brussels is trying to rewrite how our tax law works. And they're like, no, we're not having that, even though ironically rolling over and taking it would leave us 13 billion better off. But they reckon it's a point of principle.
Meta as well, which, you know, is the big parent company for Facebook, that's been ordered to pay 1.2 billion. And actually, an argument has been raised about this, whether or not these sort of fines and the amount of money that's actually there will have any impact if these companies already have billions and billions and billions. This is a drop in the water for them. And yes, it just encourages them to go, well, we can just actually skirt around the regulations and pay a little fine and we're all right.
you could well argue that the commercial benefit, so in Meta's instance, they were fined because of the unlawful transfer of users' data outside of the EU. Mm. And on, broadly speaking, that's, of course, not okay. But what's, you could certainly argue that the commercial gain by doing that, in the terms of like how easy it made for Facebook to sell ads and whatnot, they probably could arguably have made quite a bit more than 1.2 billion. That actually, the amount of money they've racked up by just skirting some of the data control laws, could argue actually that 1.2 billion isn't nearly enough, mm. arguably speaking.
And as we're coming to air, there obviously is concerns over the future of Meta in terms of jobs in Dublin, the Taoiseach saying earlier
490
today,
jobs gone.
Is
yeah.
it 490?
Yeah, to go at its Irish operation. Obviously, one of its European headquarters there in...
That's a huge blow for Dublin. That's a huge blow for Dublin.
Because there's a bigger impact on the tech ecosystem as well, that some mm-hmm. of the jobs that will be supported by Meta are third-party resellers or software auditors or anything like that.
I mean, it is
like
a backbone
well.
Sector in terms of the economy in Dublin.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose there's a question to be asked there as well. If you're talking about what Gav's saying there about the strategy is to try and, you know, protect the tech sector, you can do all you like to try and protect the tech sector, mm. but it is very up and down, as recent years have shown us, and recent layoffs at all of the big players in Dublin have actually shown. So with all the best will in the world, you can try all you like to try and protect jobs mm-hmm. in here in Ireland, but they could still go anyway. Mm-hmm. Zara, before we finish up in this segment, you've been mm-hmm. looking again at the cost of living situation with yeah. regards to families in particular. Barnardos, yes. Which has done really good studies on this over the years. They've yeah. released another one, haven't they?
Yeah, there's another report out from Barnardos today just talking about the impact the cost of living is having on individuals. And I was speaking with one family who the piece will be on the news at 5:30 this evening, so you'll have probably seen it by the time we hear the podcast. Look, the reality is families are really struggling, and it's being borne out in this report. And we're hearing anecdotes from people about the fact that their children will have three outfits, and that's the as much as they can afford to dress them in, and those three outfits will be on rotation, and the shoes will be worn till they're worn out. And like, you know, you have two small kids, Gavin. Yeah. Children grow. Mm. I mean, they're growing out of clothes at an enormous rate.
They grow
rate.
And they're messy. So yeah. like, often you might need more than one outfit per day anyway because yeah. of the breakfast that they'll spill down themselves. So mm. the idea yeah. that you are cutting corners so much that they've only got three outfits in rotation.
Yeah.
Or like you said, if they're wearing shoes out, I mean, there was one anecdote that I've already heard today as well of people who have beyond worn the shoes out, that mm-hmm. there's holes in the kids' runners and yeah. they get soaked when they're wet, but they can't afford replacements. That's the reality of where we are.
It is the reality of where we are. And I think sometimes we just need to kind of like, sometimes we talk about cost of living and it's this buzzword, but we just need to get back to kind of basics here. This is really what people are going through. And was really, you know, privileged to be able to sit down with a family today in Dublin and have a conversation with a mum, with Elizabeth, who has six kids, and she's just trying to keep the groceries on the table, confirmation year in the house, her daughter's making the confirmation, great excitement obviously about that, but you know, trying to pay off for the confirmation outfit, and then her daughter was asking for new runners. And you know, of course Elizabeth loves her kids, she wants to give them everything she can, but is really sort of finding herself. Now she's good at shopping around, she would tell you that, she'll go from different supermarkets to get different things. And, you know, she wants to be able to try and give the kids the best she can. But look, she's just saying it's getting tighter and tighter. She had €1,000 electricity bill in the door there in the last couple of months. And she's going to pay it off in installments. But she was sort of saying, you know, new bills come in every month, so it just keeps racking up and up and up. So Bernardo's highlighting that again today. I would say the call from Elizabeth and Bernardo's themselves is for the government. We had that cost of living budget, Gavin, last year. Mm. I suppose this idea of one-off help is really not enough for these families. No. There needs to be something a bit more consistent that will provide a kind of an ongoing support over the 12 months of the year.
And it's 19 weeks until the budget. And if they're ruling out any other cost of living interventions until then what is the relief for people like her who are facing €1,000 per month energy bills and the confirmations that come around and the washing machine breaks down or something else? Like, there's very little respite for those people, and those calls are only going to get louder between now and budget day.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Holly and Phil, Zara, what's the story?
I'm so obsessed with this story. I'm obsessed with the Holly and Phil thing. Do you know what? I wasn't that obsessed with it last week. And then when he was axed at the weekend, I was like, hook it to my veins. I've just
I like how you've gone
myself.
Full tabloid language there.
I have.
Axed.
TV man axed. And the thing is, like, it's not that I'm like a This Morning Viewer because I'm always at work on, but like, I do. I will admit, actually, and this is my kind of guilty pleasure. Sometimes on the weekends, the other way I was saying, I catch up on my podcast on the weekends and I do the housework or whatever, and I'd be going around with the AirPods in. And sometimes I do like to watch back segments from This Morning on YouTube and Loose Women. I'm sorry, I do.
Well, firstly, you should be watching it on the Virgin Media Player.
I mean, but you get the clips of the items on. I know you're going. I know you hate this. You're like, don't be this person. But what I would say about the Holly and Phil thing, to stay on focus.
Sorry, no one just needs to explain to people who don't know who Holly and Phil are. We just use two first names there. Just in case.
Just in case.
Because we are an explaining thing. Holly and Phil. Holly Willoughby. Phillip Schofield.
Yeah.
This morning.
Yeah.
Phillip Schofield quit over the weekend.
He quit over the weekend. Yeah. But they've kind of. No one really knows what the fallout is over. I mean, there's rumors online. Let's be blunt about it. But there's no real clarity as to what the fallout was over. I suppose. Look, we talked about it at the time when the Queen died. And the whole queue skipping saga, you know, they never seemed to really recover from that in terms of their relationship. I think there was a bit of a split in the camp over that. They've been sort of, I suppose, growing apart for a while. There was talk that she had been under his management company and I think left that a couple of years ago. Ooh. And that there had been kind of a split around all of that. Now, people will say, when I say people, I mean Eamon Holmes. Eamon Holmes is so... I actually recommend
also
looking up Eamon
until
Holmes.
He moved to GB News, an occasional co-host of This
Morning. Friday. He used to do Fridays. Yes. So yeah. Eamon Holmes and his wife, Ruth Langsford, used to do Fridays on This Morning. So Holly and Phil would do Monday to Thursday. They would do the Friday show. And then they were axed as well. And Eamon Holmes would have said at the time that he never got any clarity or insight from ITV Daytime as to why they were left go. But Eamon Holmes has been really straight in saying that Phillip Schofield was difficult to work with, and that he had been very, I suppose, what's the word, influential maybe within ITV Daytime. Okay. And that, you know, a lot of people were make or break on his say-so, kind of that he was quite a powerful individual.
The real power broker.
The organisation, okay. Yeah. Now listen, he was there for 20 years and, you know, had a very successful career for the most part in those 20 years. But Eamon Holmes would cite examples, including a time where Phillip Schofield interrupted Ruth Langsford. They were doing a crossover to Loose Women, you know, what's coming up on the show kind of thing. Now, I think if you watched it and you worked in TV, you might kind of think they were probably out of time and they were probably going overtime and maybe he caught a crosser for that reason. But if you're a viewer at home, it did come across a little bit rude. He was sort of like, okay, Ruth, we have to go now. We're kind of busy. Anyway, Eamon Holmes cites that as one example. I see you've got an Eamon Holmes few quotes.
I was reading
up there.
Some of the quotes there. Yeah. So Eamon Holmes criticised Holly Willoughby over her claim. She put out an Instagram story statement saying she was sad about Phillip Schofield finishing
the sofa
off.
She said the sofa won't be the same. But I mean, you could take that as being it won't be the same.
Like, could be best. Could be
Eamon exactly, Holmes yeah. said, well, she wanted him not there, so what is she moaning about? Holly is being as false as he is and nobody is talking about the elephant in the room. Mimicking the TV star, he said, oh, the couch will not be the same without him being there. Holmes then said, they deserve each other.
You know, oof. I watched that clip.
Saucer of milk for GB News Towers.
Do you know what, though? I'm kind of loving sassy Eamon Holmes. I'm into it.
The one thing that I kind of find strange...
I've never seen him this sassy about anything, have you?
No,
I don't actually. I have, actually.
Oh, have you?
For another day.
Okay.
He has previous guys as a news presenter. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Excuse me. One thing which I find interesting is the TV industry chat about like how, This Morning will never come back from this. Or it's almost like the late
Joe. This Morning will always be fine.
This is it. People thought that it couldn't survive Richard and Judy. And do you remember the Richard and Judy days?
Listen, I remember the Richard and Judy days? Don't insult me. I adored the Richard and Judy
people
days.
People thought when they're gone, that's it now. It's never going to be the same.
Like, good thing about being off school sick when you were a kid was like Richard and Judy in the morning and like your mom bringing you tea and toast on the couch. It was fabulous. Like, I mean, This Morning is an institution.
I wouldn't say that's now a standard off school thing for Irish kids, now, to be honest.
But
Richard and Judy.
In the 90s, like, it was, you know, well, I mean, Richard and Judy was on in our house.
Kids' TV channels trying to put anything else on. It was pretty much the only thing on.
But This Morning is an institution. I mean, look, it absolutely is. There's no point in saying otherwise. It absolutely is. And, you know, look, Alison Hammond and is it Dermot O'Leary?
Yeah, are doing the next 2 weeks.
At the moment, they're doing the 2 weeks. They're very good. Yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no...
They do Fridays. Craig Doyle.
I remember I saw him. Recognised
and Rochelle
former
Humes
face of
and Marvin.
UPC Broadband.
Yeah.
Rochelle and Marvin Humes have done it a few times. Like, I mean, look, it's the kind of show, like, it's, I think you could... You could slap people into it. I think it will survive.
I think it will.
I do think it will survive.
One other show that is going to survive and has a new face behind the desk is The Late Late Show. Patrick Keelty confirmed as the new host. It has basically been a poorly kept secret now for the last number of weeks at this point in time. Some, I think it was interesting to see some of the media scrutiny from some papers in particular about the fact that he's living in London and whether or not he'll be disconnected from Irish people around that. I find that
As if internet communications technology doesn't exist.
Well, like, without putting too fine a point on it, Patrick Keelty is as Irish as you'll get anybody. Mm. He's a big GAA man. He has a very fresh perspective on Irishness, which we haven't heard from anybody who's presented the Late Late Show before. With all the greatest respect of the world for three of the best broadcasters Ireland have ever had in terms of Ryan Tuberty, Pat Kenny and Gay Byrne, all of them have lived in very particular socio-economic backgrounds, all of them living in Dublin. Patrick Keelty will be coming from outside of the RTE bubble, which is also a big thing. Also, a northern perspective on things, which is often overlooked for a show which is broadcast in the north as well. Family backstory is very interesting as well. Of course, he's spoken openly and very effectively over the years with documentaries as well about the murder of his father when he was just 16 by members of the UFF. But there is other criticisms which have been levelled at him about in terms of commuting back and forth from London in terms of emissions, which is probably...
Yeah.
Like, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. There's probably... I think overall, in fairness, this is actually probably going to start a conversation broader than RT in terms of how many people need to fly back and forth from Dublin to London for business. Multiple times every week. That happens all the time.
Well, which I think is possibly the more important bit, because people will think that Patrick Keelty is some kind of sole offender, that he's one of the only people that's going to be like hopping across the sea every week, when in fact it's much more commonly done than a lot of people might think, particularly at higher ends of business where people are juggling business interests on both sides of the sea and do it quite regularly. Well, it's not all that remarkable.
It's the busiest, I think, it's somebody described the other day as the busiest between two capitals of different countries, air route in the world.
One of the busiest.
One of them anyway,
I think,
definitely.
Like Beijing and Hong Kong, I think, possibly overtook it at some point. But that, like Dublin to London, when you just think of the volume of flights that there are every day.
Actually, there's nearly one every hour in the evening time.
There you go.
Like the Heathrow flight back to Dublin, I think there's one at like 7, 8 and 9 or something. Mm-hmm. There's nearly an hourly one in the evening.
One thing I think will be interesting about Patrick Keelty, and by the way, I agree with all of your aforementioned assessments, and I actually think he's been slightly unlucky in that he has been announced as getting the job after Claire Byrne and Miriam McCallaghan.
Can I just say, I actually really wanted a woman to get the job. Yeah. I have to be totally honest with you.
When we were talking about it before.
I was disappointed that it wasn't a female presenter.
Yeah, we all talked about, we all really wanted Claire Byrne to get it.
I fully expected Claire Byrne, and I don't mind
telling you, I messaged Claire Byrne to say that I really wanted her to get it.
But I think that Patrick Keelty is somewhat unlucky in that he may now come across as being like, well, he was the next available person, rather than being a very good appointee in his own
right. I don't think it's that. I mean, Claire didn't want it in the end, and she was very clear about not wanting it. But I do think that Patrick Keelty is absolutely going to be great at this. I just really would have liked to have seen a woman get a chance at it.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long he wants to stick around at it as well. But I think
it may not be as long term as it's been in before.
Oh, probably not.
You know
what
I mean? Like, and even the fact that Ryan Tuberty set a precedent that you do it for a period of time and
Pat
you move
did it
forward.
For shorter. Pat did it for 10 years and him said that's enough.
Yeah,
so,
fair.
Yeah.
I think there's a potential bonus to it. And I think it almost has fallen into RT's lap, the Patrick Keelty situation, in that they probably didn't think at the start of the process. But obviously there was a lot of reporting around this. And from what I know from inside RT, it was expected that Claire Byrne would be the person who would take the helm of the Late Late Show. But they have now a person who's going to be based in London for a lot of the time, who has big connections over there. There is often criticism at the Late Late Show in terms of the quality of the guests they get from overseas. And also, if you're not having somebody who's from the RTE bubble, the dependence on RTE guests from various shows throughout the week might be lessened as a result of this.
Also, the accusation of like putting the canteen on the couch on a Friday night.
I think it addresses some of that. And obviously it's a good opportunity to have, if you have an outsider, just shake up the format, which is something which is long overdue.
On the flip side, very briefly though, on a Friday night, Tuberty had made something of a fine art post-COVID of pre-recording items during the week and have done in the same set, so that if a good guest was available, but they were only around on a Tuesday afternoon, Tuberty was fine sitting into the studio and putting on the same suit he was going to wear on Friday and getting it done and dusted. That's not going to be an option available to Patrick Keelty if he's only going to come over on a Thursday morning or whenever it is. So it'll be interesting to see whether they're able to compensate for that.
Yeah, secure the guest. But I think that's a good point you make about the connections and being in London and actually being based around, you know, maybe having that access to sort of more high profile guests.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting before we wrap up, like the idea as well that because you're from the north and you're living abroad makes you somehow less connected to Ireland, I just think it's just slightly askew. So many people in our country have had to leave for a time
and
to live abroad.
And are connected to what's going on at home.
It'd be like saying people who listen to the group chat abroad aren't connected to Ireland, and we'd hate for people to feel that. But anyway, best wishes to Ryan as he finishes up. Last show this week, this Friday.
Yeah. Parting thoughts on Ryan's legacy, I suppose, at the Late Late Show.
Toy show definitely is biggest
toy
legacy.
Show,
isn't
I
it?
Think so. Yeah.
Good luck trying to follow that.
Now, we have a couple of sports stories to finish the podcast this week. I think it would be remiss of us if we didn't mention what has been happening in Spain. To Vinicius Jr., one of the brightest stars in world football, plays for Real Madrid, but it's an ongoing situation, Gavin, which has really come to the boil, I think, over last weekend.
Perhaps the only remaining superstar left in La Liga, really, in some terms, after the departure of Lionel Messi. Certainly the star of the Real Madrid team. And some of the abuse that he's just been getting from the terraces, and this really culminated last weekend against Valencia, has been shocking, like genuinely shocking. And I think it's a real reckoning for La Liga, because this has been bubbling on for a while, and he's been the victim of racist abuse and racist chants on the stands for a long time. But with this very laissez-faire, hands-off approach to ever penalising anyone who's been responsible for it. But it seems to have just reached this tipping point now where he himself has spoken out about it, and he effectively seems to have thrown in the towel on playing in Spain now forevermore. But, or it almost seems that way, that it's very difficult for him to reconcile himself to Spanish society because of the generally standoff approach. And it's almost, in a way, it's not a sports story, it's a societal story, because he just has been the victim of such horrendous treatment. And like, rather than coming to his side or trying to rally behind him, there almost seems to be this idea of now with further pulling down the shutters and marginalising him even more.
Yeah, four people were arrested over the hanging of an effigy, which effectively was of him in Madrid. He has documented online basically all of the instances of racist chanting, racist abuse that has been targeted at him over the course of this season, even. And he just is relentlessly getting it. And La Liga, which is the Spanish league, doesn't seem to want to take any firm action on it. I think the most damning thing about it was Valencia's sporting newspaper put up a no more, a big sort of, this is the end of this sort of situation. But it wasn't about racism. It was about complaints about racism from Real Madrid and from Vinicius, which just shows there is a problem there. Stop complaining about this. This is all a conspiracy led by Real Madrid, which is effectively very disgusting, and it's just something to keep an eye on. But domestically, Katie Taylor had her homecoming fight against Chantelle Cameron, who won very handily in the end.
I was really heartbroken for Katie Taylor.
That's tough.
Yeah. So tough. At home, it's so tough.
Well, this was the thing that I think a lot of people overlooked, how much of a sporting challenge it was going to be, because we had just turned it into this national festival. They're like, oh, Katie finally has a pro fight in Dublin. Let's have a big hooli. Isn't she great? Not realising that she was fighting the undisputed champion in the weight above her, moving beyond her natural weight to fight an undisputed champion.
So somebody taller,
who has longer reach and is 40 years younger than her. Like, that was always going to
and
be
a big athlete.
Is the age
fighter
a factor, do you think, when you get to that stage in your career?
It would be, yeah. If you're 36 fighting against a 32-year-old who is slightly more explosive, who has won a larger percentage of her fights through knockout, it was always going to be an uphill battle. Interestingly now, they're talking about if she does go through with a rematch, they might rematch at Katie's weight. So Cameron would come down and fight her on her own terms. So
That's a tough.
So Katie went up weight category for this. So she tried to fight again. I don't think that makes sense. If she's meant to be, is this meant to be a homecoming for Katie Taylor?
Yeah. Brought her out of her natural weight category. Yeah. Take on a glamour fight.
And now if there's a rematch, Chantelle Cameron, who's a naturally bigger athlete and has already shown herself to have outboxed Katie Taylor in that fight, is going to be in a lower weight category. I just think it's an outmatch thing again. I think this is almost a situation where I can sort of feel, I can see the arguments that have been over the last number of days that Katie should call it a day and go out with her head held high, as opposed to taking, you know, potentially more difficult and more upsetting sort of outcomes out
you
of
never
this.
Wanted to go off the back of two defeats prospectively. So and
she's
that,
nothing
that's
left to prove.
Risk.
She's nothing left to prove.
But do you think that is that she wants one more win before she decides
naturally enough, I think people in those sort of positions, boxers never call it a day themselves. You know, there's all sporting stories, like all political careers, end in disappointment. It's very, very rare that you'll get somebody who'll go out undefeated at the very, very top. But that shouldn't take anything away from
the
record that she has.
She's such an icon. I mean, like, if she walked out the door tomorrow, she would forever be that icon. And I think the things that she would be remembered for won't be really what happened last weekend. She'll be remembered 100%. For success. She'll be remembered for how much she inspired young people to be involved in boxing, particularly young girls. So I just think, you know, like, last weekend is disappointing for her, but it won't be the thing she's most remembered for.
I hope there's somebody in her ear reminding her of that, because it's very easy to go out thinking that your last fight is the thing you'll be remembered for.
Absolutely not.
Especially homecoming,
so
I hope so.
Speaking of homecomings.
Oh, yeah.
Homecomings. Leinster Rugby were beaten by La Rochelle. I'm not disguising any glee in my voice about that. That's not what I'm doing at all.
No.
There was a big fight on Liveline and on the streets, as our king is telling us. But it's all spilled over in the gentleman's game.
So I went to the Heineken Cup final, the most undeserving person in the crowd for a ticket to the Heineken Cup final. It was a very last minute thing. I mean, absolutely wouldn't be deserving to be there as a Munster person as well. But anyway.
As a Munster person. Where were your loyalties?
I'll be honest, I did cheer for Leinster. Did cheer for Leinster. And I'll tell you why. Because I suppose I support Ireland on the whole. And I felt that there are players on the Leinster team who play on the Ireland team. So that was my kind of... Now, in saying that, I would say as a Cork-born woman whose grandfather worships at the altar of Ronan O'Gara, I would say I was delighted for Ronan O'Gara in the end.
No, stop hedging your bets.
No, I think I was pretty new. I was a neutral observer, but I did cheer. I did cheer on Leinster. I will say I did cheer on Leinster. I don't mind telling you that. I think it was, you know, obviously very disappointing.
You're
for
very
them.
Much in the minority.
But
being
I would
a Munster
say
person
I did hear people bickering though. When I told you that there was a lady started having a go at a bunch of young lads who had La Rochelle. They were from Cork and they had La Rochelle
Fair
jerseys
play,
and things. And she was like, "You're a disgrace. That's this is nonsense. Your own country." There was nonsense. A bit of a row. Like there was a bit of a barney. We were walking out of the stadium.
This is mental that this happens. That you have to obviously Munster and Leinster is a rivalry, right?
Yeah.
This is like saying if Liverpool got into the European Cup final.
That United fans would go
like Gavin Riley and the Manchester United fans would be like, come on Liverpool, do it for our league in our country.
No, absolutely not.
But the people who rang in live line.
I also think though that if Liverpool were in a Champions League final, it would also be like phenomenally petty to start actively cheering.
But
the
do you not think
team.
That?
No, it's not. Sorry.
To show up in the stadium wearing their colours to be like, yeah.
They probably had the tickets anyway, as you do for a European finals.
That's what happened with the tickets that I ended up going. Those tickets were bought a year ago. And people didn't know who was going to end up where. So.
You buy them in the hope that your own team gets there.
Yeah, but you can offload them.
It was people beside us who were like, I think their team was Saracens or something like that. Like there was people in the audience that weren't like Leinster or whatever.
This expectation that Munster fans wouldn't cheer on one of the greatest legends that has ever pulled on their jersey against their heated rivals is absolutely bedlam. It just shows that people do not know that sporting fandom, at least half of it, isn't just the support of your own team. It's the schadenfreude of your biggest rivals getting handed an embarrassing loss.
But do you not subscribe to the logic that like there are players on the Leinster team who play for Ireland and we're all Ireland?
Couldn't care less.
It's not a big cheering on those individuals.
In a World Cup year, Richard, would you not want to go in on a winning streak?
And again, not that I know a lot about sport, but in a World Cup year, I would have thought cheer on those who will be playing for Ireland in the World Cup, surely. That's good logic. No?
Best of luck to them, but there's a couple of Irish people who are involved in that La Rochelle as well. And congratulations to them. I hope they have the best of times. Okay. We are all rooting for them on the group chat.
We're having post-mortem for Ireland not winning the World Cup because of the fragility that crept in last weekend of the Aviva.
I'll take the blame. I'll take the heat on that one. But that's a bombshell to land it on for the end of this week's group chat. Zara, Gavin, thank you very much
for all of your thoughts,
all of your views. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much for joining us here on the group chat.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.